Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies and, more importantly, the people that constitute this sector of media and advertising that we all call local. So where are they from? What makes them tick? What business and life lessons can we draw from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is the team from Gravy Analytics, which is a longtime innovator in location intelligence, particularly around offline foot traffic around local events. So we talked to the company from our studio in San Francisco, along with former Street Fight president Anne-Marie Steven. So here's our discussion with Gravy Analytics. So hello to all of you.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So we actually have a lot to talk about, including diving deeper into everything I just mentioned. But first, let's start with some quick intros. So Jeff, why don't we start with you, and then we'll go to Dan and Anne-Marie. So just a quick bit about Gravy and your role.
Sure. Appreciate and thank you for the time. Jeff White, founder and CEO of Gravy Analytics, started in 2011. And really, what we do in the thesis of our company is really understanding the places and events that people attend so we can get greater and deeper consumer insights.
Nice. A lot we get to unpack there. Dan, tell us about yourself. And you're actually representing Gravy, but coming from the investor perspective.
Yeah, thanks for having us. My name is Dan McKeegan. I'm a founding partner of Spring Lake Equity Partners. And prior to Spring Lake, I served as a partner for Tudor Investment Corp's private equity group, which was the predecessor since 2000. So I've been investing in media and tech for almost 20 years now. And one of our most well-regarded companies is certainly Gravy, which I serve on the board of.
Absolutely. That's great. And we look forward to getting your perspective as an investor in all of this. So let's actually jump right into it. So we can also remind the audience that Jeff, you were on the show about a year ago, and we recommend people to go back to that episode and check it out, and we should be saying welcome back. But Anne-Marie, you more recently have actually spent a lot of time with these gentlemen talking about their product and points of differentiation. So why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, that's really what brought us here. You know, earlier, I think we all had the opportunity to have dinner sometime in March in the spring. And as a result of that dinner is why we're here, because we had such an engaging conversation that I felt like everyone who couldn't be at the dinner with us could at least experience some of the thoughts Jeff and Dan have to share via our podcast. So there was a lot discussed around live event measurement. Certainly, Jeff, that's your expertise. And then, Dan, you have that landscape vision on location intelligence and media, as you said, and certainly the privacy issues that have come up. So, Jeff, maybe you want to kick us off because you were so receptive in something I was interested in terms of live event measurement in a recent study. I was hoping you could maybe touch on that. You know, June was a big event around Pride, and I thought maybe you might be able to speak to that and some other of the events and kind of work that you've been doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me back. I guess you're giving me a second chance to get it right. So thank you. So indeed, and maybe it's best to just take a step backwards and really believe why we think that people's attendances to events conveys a much deeper and richer signal to their actual interests and passions. So whether it's the Pride event or others, we simply believe that, you know, on the back of when we started the company, really, 20 years of having this thing called a digital cookie and being able to create deeper, richer experiences online based upon people's behaviors online, we simply believe that if we can understand the events in particular that people attend, that's a much deeper and richer signal. So I would say, I mean, whether that's the Pride event and all the associated Pride events that we were profiling and examining back earlier this year, or whether it's attendances to any of your favorite passionate things, wine tastings or otherwise, we just anchor on that and try to glean aggregated consumer insights based upon people's attendances to those things.
You opened up a question for me. Can, when we talk about those events, can you talk about the size and scale? Because that you did touch on that. So wine tastings to a large outdoor event. Like, what does events mean for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So in our landscape, events mean everything from certainly the largest of the large, the, you know, 200,000 person NASCAR race over a weekend, down to three people having a book reading club at the end of their block and everything in between. And just to give you a sense of what that looks like on any given day, we will process over a million events forward looking inside of our platform. So it's massive scale. And, you know, we always say, yes, it's very interesting to understand the people that went to the large, you know, country music festival over the weekend. But there are 100 country karaoke's going on every single night across the country, and they are equally as passionate as those 30,000 that went to the singular event.
So, Jeff, let me ask a quick question at a high level without getting too into the weeds technologically speaking. But there are a lot of folks out there that are collecting intelligence, and there are different methodologies that really speak to the integrity of that data set. And since you guys kind of specialize in events as a kind of way to develop those consumer profiles, how are you collecting that data? How is it done in an anonymous way in terms of associating a certain device with that event and then targeting it on an ongoing basis? And what are some of the kind of ways you're bringing that together?
Yeah, absolutely fantastic question. So at its core, 100% of our data is collected on the back of mobile application usage. It's all aggregated, anonymized. It's done with 100% consumer consent and opt-in, and through our partner network and affiliates, they're leveraging our ability to create contextual understandings of those consumers to enrich the experiences and the services that they delivered back to those consumers. But it's all on the back of mobile phone applications. And it's all 100% aggregated, anonymized, so we don't ever know from a PI level who specifically those individual consumers are, but we know on aggregate the attendances of these devices at those events.
And getting back to, I probably sidetracked some of the answer to Anne-Marie's questions about some of the great findings from your most recent kind of tracking around a lot of those happenings in June.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think in what she's related to is this Pride event attendance study we did, which is around Pride events that were captured throughout the country. And one of the interesting attributes that we look at and have done a lot of correlative analysis on is that there is a direct correlation to people's passion and conviction to causes and associated events to the distance that they traveled to get to those events. And it just logically makes sense. You might imagine, right? There is a commitment that is much stronger when you travel 1,000 miles for an event versus 1,000 yards, right? And certainly, so we look at that across the board at all the events that we measure and create insights for, is how it's duration of attendance, it's distance traveled, and what are the associated analytics we can create as a result of that.
And then that's the intent measurement. So if I'm that passionate about X event, country music, Pride, you've given those NASCAR, from a brand perspective, then from taking those metrics, duration, distance, and others, then you could correlate, sounds like, the intensity of the relationship of that to NASCAR, for example. And if I'm a brand marketer associated with NASCAR, then I would be able to more directly, clearly understand where and when and who I should be
communicating
with. Okay, perfect.
And I use my interest as an example. So I love wines, right? And it is truly a signal that if someone were to cookie me and see me searching for wine online, that's a signal that I have an interest in wine, sure. If someone were to look at my purchase behaviors and understand that as part of the $300 basket size at Costco, I put in the $12 bottle of Yellowtail. Agreed. That's a signal that I might like wine. But as a marketer, as a brand, if you were able to understand that I actually took time out of my day, bought tickets, spent my weekend at a wine festival or a wine tasting event or a sommelier training class, those are the kind of visceral convictions and commitments that a consumer might have that reinforces our ability to understand their level of interest.
You know, given that consumers, we're hearing a lot of this on the retail and brand side, and I'd be interested in Jeff and or Dan for you to comment on this. It sounds like through a live event measurement, right? We're seeing on the millennials, you know, millennials like experiences or Gen Z or whatever, you know, that the consumer is shifting into an experiential kind of shopping experience or an engagement experience. I'm assuming then this data really has probably gotten even richer as that consumer behavior has shifted.
Yeah, Anne-Marie, this is Dan. I think I'll take this one. It is actually a great question. The data sets have gotten a lot richer and a lot more density. And one of the things that I think is what we see from our perspective as investors in Media Math and Gravy is that that data set is anonymized and we take the consumer privacy very seriously. So consumer first, all the PII information is removed, not stored. And we allow consumers to opt in to be anonymized so we can better target advertising or personalize a website for them. So in the holistic standpoint, the data set's getting much richer. And I think our consumer-first approach to privacy is starting to resonate with the industry.
Let's talk about that because that is top of mind. I think we keep hearing more and more about this. As a matter of fact, I know. I mean, all of us have been in the industry for some time, and certainly it's not news, you know, from the insider's point of view. But it seems to me that particularly since you know, Facebook's very kind of public incidents with Cambridge Analytica, I don't need to go down that road, but that really kind of brought it front and center, I think, for the consumer. So, Dan, can you speak to some of this? I know that there's been a lot of activity on this front. I feel like we are at the very beginning of communicating to consumers and, you know, about data and how data is collected, right? I think then we're starting to see questions about who owns it. I'm starting to see more technologies. They have been around, but getting more play around. The consumer owns the data and then they can sell it back to a brand, you know, then the brand pays them for use of their data. Like, it feels like we're just at the tip of the iceberg on this privacy issue.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, a lot has happened in the last 12 to 18 months. We GDPR, which was a regulation, was implemented in Europe. We had CCPA go through a review process and will go into law in January of next year. And as part of that, I think there's been a refocusing back on the consumer and making sure we're getting the proper consents and abilities for them to know how their data is being used. Facebook, obviously, a big abuser of that trust, and was, you know, FTC fined them for that, but it was such a minor fine relative to their revenue or profits, very minimal. I think the regulations that are coming forward, it's challenging in the sense that the intent is there, but the outcome may not be, in the sense that regulation usually helps the big tech. They can spend the money to adjust their systems to comply. They can continue to develop PACs or political action groups that lobby extensively to alter the law or change it over time, where those regulations tend to stifle innovation within the startup communities and make it more difficult to compete against the bigger players. So I'm not of the belief that regulation is actually going to help the consumer. It will probably just help the big tech more than the little tech. What may help, though, is the ongoing review by the FTC and the Department of Justice on big tech, because as we had with Standard Oil and AT&T and IBM, breaking up some of these monopoly-like behaviors would spur a new avenue of innovation in this country, in my belief.
So how do you untangle it? I mean, that's a big question. We may not have time on this podcast for that. But, you know, like when you look at a Facebook, where would they even begin to like break that up, or Google the ones that question? I mean, it really seems, I'm sure they thought that about the examples that you gave back when. What are your thoughts on like how did the approach, how would you even begin to approach something like that?
Well, clearly there's dominant behavior between certain large tech companies. You have Google, which controls search and now is starting to influence significantly ad serving. They dominate those two markets as well as display. Mm-hmm. And concentration of power there continues to be something. So you could separate out various activities into separate companies. On the Amazon of the world, they're obviously an e-commerce powerhouse, now starting to use that data set they generate from the stuff we all buy to generate a very strong advertising business. So you could break that up. Facebook, clearly there's different platforms from Instagram and the Facebook site we all know. You could separate those from WhatsApp. So I do think there's an opportunity to look at each and every one differently. But that, to me, will have more of an impact on the startup community than regulation, which would be probably a negative headwind to the industry.
And because they'll be able to make the investments, the theory would be that the large companies, let's say the FTC, puts in the regulations, or the Capitol Hill does, they're going to be a financially heavy commitment that would be prohibitive to startups making those same investments. Google could afford to make whatever changes, but a company that's venture funded under $1 million couldn't do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the cost to comply becomes so great that it stifles innovation because the startup community can't afford it.
Which is not good for really the economy ultimately, right? So I would think there would be a trickle down effect in jobs, in venture funding, certainly stimulating the economy, and also moving technologies and businesses, industries into the next chapter with new ideas.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Jeff, when you look at your business, and I don't want you to, reveal anything, proprietary, but how have you navigated the consumer question? Does that come up for you?
Oh, we live and die by it, and frankly, and in some sense, I think to Dan's point, if we're really trying to protect and understand the consumer, then this isn't really a regulation problem; it's a consent issue, and ensuring that consumers are fully aware, all the consents and data transparency is in place. We live and breathe it every day, and as part of what we do, as you can imagine. Being very straightforward about ensuring that we never have any PII, that 100% of our data is collected with consumer opt-in and transparent consents. We are already spending a large portion of our time continuously auditing and surveilling that effort.
So, Jeff, let's also talk about the outputs and the end users of this data. So you're collecting these kind of rich, valuable profiles of privacy compliant data for people and devices as a function of the events that they go to, and you're able to just draw this really great data from it. Let's talk a little bit about who's using that data and what for, and a lot of it I presume is for marketing and ad targeting. There's probably also some operational or logistical things that we can go into, but within the marketing bucket, what are the different types of products for which this is ideally suited? Is it largely horizontal across the board, or is it CPG products, or any other kind of category where this makes a lot of sense in terms of targeting?
Well, I always, and I think everyone's sick of me saying it around here, but I think understanding your customers never is going out of style. Mm. And if our thesis is true and continues to be resonant in the marketplace, then the information we have here is just the greatest that we've ever seen in terms of our ability to help understand customers. And so prominent use cases, I think what we have seen really emerge even recently is measurement and attribution. It's a significant use mm-hmm. case now. If I'm AT&T and I'm advertising at all of the MLB ballparks, for those that are in the ballpark and were exposed to my ongoing advertisements, does that impact behaviors? Do those consumers then go at a more steady clip to AT&T stores, or do they still equally visit Sprint's stores or T-Mobile or otherwise? Another one is that we've seen a lot of effort spent now is around asset allocation and things like site selections for both retailers, QSRs, hospitalities. If I'm Marriott and one of my principal charters in life is to fly my flags at existing properties, which ones are target-rich environments? What do the consumers do when they're there? Do they frequent the spas, or do they go out to Italian restaurants? And how do I handle my asset allocations as a result? It's widespread use cases that are just really, I believe we've only scratched the surface on them, Frank.
And that brings me to my next question, which is, what are the untapped areas of, whether it be product categories? You know, you mentioned hospitality, you mentioned a few in there. Are there any kind of large verticals that you believe could really benefit from this data that represent growth areas for Gravy?
Yeah, I think, you know, the original use cases very early on in our industries were a lot around retailers, obviously, right? Because they were A, struggling, and B, trying to drive foot traffic.
Jeff, that hasn't changed, just so you know.
Yeah, right? Well, maybe there are fewer of them, so they share the pain less. But in reality, if anybody wants to compete with the Amazons and others that are being disrupted across the board, understanding consumer behaviors is just prominence, mm-hmm. right? And you see that in automotive industries. You see it in insurance. You see it everywhere across the board. This information about true consumer behaviors and aggregated and in a way that grids great analytics, then it's going to change everything how the way people analyze this.
So let me ask you on that point. So I've been watching, you know, the financial news. It's one of my favorite addictions. And they, you know, we've been, one day we're talking about, I'm not asking you to make a prediction on this, by the way, but one day we're talking about recession. Literally, this is the news this week. There's going to be a recession. Then the following day, there isn't going to be a recession. Then the following day, there is going to be a recession. And then they point to RV sales, which I thought was a very interesting metric. I wasn't familiar with it personally, but that RV sales are a leading indicator of an impending recession. So potentially. Right. So if there's a decline in RV sales, and but it's only been accurate 2 out of 7 times or 5 huh. times, some weird thing. So I'm not sure even why they report on that metric. But to that point, given that you're watching behavior over many segments of the population and variety of interests, again, not asking you to comment, have you seen shifts in, you know, in those behaviors that might indicate changes or based on comparison to past behaviors when we've had changes in the economy?
Well, and Dan, this is probably going to be one I'm going to throw it over to you, because I'll tell you, for us, we're a data company, right? The interpretation of that data I leave to experts like Dan. But I would say this is that and I don't understand necessarily the RV sale connection. I would argue.
I don't
that
know. Talk to CNBC. That's the what they reported.
Well, maybe people buy RVs when they're trying to get tight on expenses and live there instead of a house. Or maybe they spend money on RVs when they have discretionary income. I'm not sure. But we could certainly understand and predict at a much more granular level people's propensity, their visitations, for example, to campgrounds, their visitations to RV lots and otherwise, then smart people like Dan take that data and make predictions.
Before you jump in, Dan, it's interesting. I think it's a great question, Emory, because traditionally we've seen a lot of sources of investment and research, such as in some cases hedge fund managers, look at things like satellite imagery around the parking lots of a Walmart, you know, throughout right. the quarter leading up to earnings in terms of where they're going to kind of place their chips. And it's interesting now, you know, that instead of satellite imagery, it's more kind of ground truth data in terms of gleaning some of those insights from an investor perspective.
Yeah, no, I mean, those are great questions. I mean, I think the articles about the RV sales is probably more to do with tourism and the tourists, both whether it be international or domestic, really impact our economy significantly. And I think there's a heightened level of concern that people are starting to question the outlook. And if they question the outlook, they may not take that trip or buy that RV that they had hoped to use on a vacation. As it relates to the data, really good points. A lot of people on Wall Street, sophisticated hedge funds, will use satellite data. And they'll actually count cars in parking lots to figure out if Best Buy or Target is going to beat or meet its quarterly estimates, just using those macro tools that are available to them. The data set that Gravy has is so much more rich and in depth of data that we can actually count the cell phones without actually counting them with the data set. We can see which ones went in, how long they dwelled, right, inside the facility, whether they are a Home Depot customer, but really they go to Lowe's four times as often. So it's really much more insightful data that the Gravy Analytics has over what is used today in financial services.
Yeah, I think that kind of, you know, my history, you know, in the video analytics world, you know, you can tell from footfall, for example, at a very local level, if a particular retailer may not, you know, it was a leading indicator, right? You see the decline in footfall, maybe sales would hold on, right? Sales would sustain. However, the actual physical footfall declined. And then maybe about 18 months later, then the sales would fall off, mirroring the behavior 18 months earlier. Then ultimately, in some cases, leading to, you know, chains going out of business. So it was a leading indicator, that behavioral data, which is one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about it, is that it is I think Mike said it, a ground truth, a true north, whatever saying we want to use. But it's a real measure to what is happening, a consumer's physical behavior.
Yeah, it was, and Amory, if you haven't seen it, we have a published study that we did. It's on our website during the government shutdown.
Yes.
Which seems like a long time ago, but it wasn't that distant. And the impact to restaurant traffic, as an example, it was dramatic in this area in terms of that. And so those kinds of things are definitely correlating and sometimes leading indicators of what's going to happen.
So what other types of outcomes, like kind of creative uses of the data, have we not seen that you guys think could open up? I mean, we've talked to the obvious kind of and primary marketing objectives. Jeff, you mentioned some attribution. And then we talked about to inform kind of investment decisions. What other kind of enterprise operational functions could this data inform? I mean, I'm thinking everything from supply chain management to asset tracking. Are there any of those areas that you think like just haven't really exploded yet, but could?
Well, and Dan certainly has a broader landscape view than I do. I'll tell you, as a technologist, one of the things I'm keenly interested in is what we have done a lot of to date is the past equals prologue analysis, right? Just creating past behaviors and correlate them to consumer behaviors to try to create predictive models. Hmm. I think what I'm really, really interested in the forthcoming, and really it's going to be really here sooner than later, is leveraging AI and sophisticated ML to create predictive analytics based upon what is really big and fragmented data sets that we have. That's when I think we can really start to get very powerful around understanding predictive behaviors around consumers.
Yeah, we're entering an election cycle. Are there any kind of implications there in terms of the way your data could be used predictively?
On the election cycle, you're going to see a study that we're publishing actually, I think, early next week. It'll be on our site, that we actually did a study around people's attendances to all of the political events tied to each candidate on the Democratic Party. To understand both conviction, correlation again, to commitment and interest levels. If we're right, that could serve as an early predictor to what some of these outcomes might be.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I would just add, I mean, Jeff's exactly right. One of the areas that I think in the future, we're not there yet, but is public health and in other areas. If you think about it, if you've been exposed to a virus in a certain area, like the Zika virus, what type of data would help the CDC respond, for example, to how exposed are we to this virus, and do we need to do a more broad public outreach because people travel beyond that area, or a hurricane path? you know, people disclose if they left or not a certain area, but how many people actually are still around after a hurricane. Huh. That type of data can be very valuable and help save lives.
Yeah, very interesting. So winding down, I would love to hear from each of you about what you're kind of working on now and what you're most excited about for the remainder of the year. So Jeff, from your perspective, like the kind of from a product perspective, Dan, from a kind of investing and macro trend. So Jeff, you first.
Sure. So I think, you know, for the rest of this year, I think we're squarely focused on, and just to kind of, you know, give you a quick synopsis, we had probably spent, you know, if you think about this industry, a lot of years evangelizing and educating the marketplace on how this data is A, powerful, and then B, the associated use cases for it. I think we're starting to eclipse and get beyond that. So what we're really focused on right now is going deeper with a lot of our current customers and really understanding what are the permeated use cases that they hadn't thought of yet. I go back to the asset allocations. I don't think that was a prominent use case with many of our hospitality customers 2 years ago, but today it is. Yeah. And so the more we can leverage this data for not just marketing and advertising use cases, I think the stronger and more valuable this proposition becomes.
Excellent. Dan, how about you?
Yeah, I definitely think there's some new areas that are up and coming. Obviously, what Gravy is doing is on the cutting edge and some of the most innovative stuff we've seen. But in addition to that, looking at data and privacy more specifically around brands and agencies that need to start to install their own platforms or consumer data platforms to help allow them to comply with future regulations is an area of interest to me. And the second area is around this idea of almost like a privacy bureau, where there might be an opportunity to have a credit-like bureau, but for privacy that allows consumers to see how their data is being used, just like a credit score would look like. You'd see the same thing for a privacy score. So I think those areas are on the forefront, but what Gravy's tackling today is probably the most exciting area I've seen in a long time.
Awesome. So that's actually all the time we have. I want to thank you all for spending time with us and for some great insights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vim. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for future episodes of Heard on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, and also stay tuned for lots more writings and multimedia and, once again, awards from Street Fight. So I'm Mike Bolin. This has been Heard on the Street. Thanks for listening.